Welcome to the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. The EHS exists to explore all aspects and all periods of the history of Christianity. And in our podcasts, we welcome guests to discuss a wide range of topics. If you want to know more about the EHS, then visit our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com, or our social media pages.
Thank you for joining us in this EHS podcast episode. I'm your host, Angela Platt. I'm currently finishing my PhD at Royal Holloway, looking at love and religious families in the 18th and 19th centuries, and I'm also a humanities lecturer at St. Mary's University in Twickenham. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by Dr. Lyneth Miller-Runberg. And indeed, Lyneth is an assistant professor of history at Anderson University, with teaching and research interests in gender, dance, emotion, and lay religion. She has published articles in 16th Century Journal, Church History and Religious Culture, Dance Research Journal, and Liminalities, as well as an edited collection with Routledge, The Cursed Carolers in Context, which came out in 2021. Her monograph, Women, Dance, and Parish Religion in England from 1300 to 1640, Negotiating the Steps of Faith, is forthcoming with Boydell Press in November 2022. And indeed, this monograph is the topic of our discussion today. I'm so privileged to be here today with Dr. Lyneth Miller-Runberg for this podcast interview. Thank you so much for joining us, Lyneth.
Thank you for having me, Angela. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is absolutely all ours. And as I noted in the introduction, we're really looking forward to discussing your upcoming monograph, the one on women, dance, and parish religion in England from 1300 to 1640, Negotiating the Steps of Faith. And my first question relates directly to the broader topic as noted in your title, looking at dance and parish religion. So firstly, I was wondering if you could speak to us a little bit about what was dance within parish religion? What did it look like and how was it contextualized?
Right. So I think one thing that might be surprising for a modern audience is just how much dance took place in a religious context in medieval Europe. Starting more broadly with Europe in general, we have dances performed by clergy as a part of services. One of the things that scholars have noted is the dance that's performed during the Easter Mass, where there's a whole song and procession, and this dance that takes place on the labyrinth involving a ball and a like chorus and response. That's a huge part of the celebration of Easter in churches, especially in medieval France. We have many different forms of celebration of various religious festivities, saints' days, holy days that involve the priests and the clerics dancing as a part of the service, as a part of the observation. Along with that, we also have a lot of liturgical dance that takes place and is performed by the laity, by the ordinary men and women of individual parishes. Now, this can take a lot of different forms during this period. Sometimes this is a procession through the town behind the host, in which we know that there are dancers from the records that have been left behind that specify payments to the dancers in this procession. There are also lights and feasts that are kind of fundraisers for the church funds, where you'll come and you'll pay and there will be a dance and ale and celebration. And then along with this, we have a number of medieval dancing saints. Elizabeth of Spalbeck is one of these examples. And she actually has a lengthy performance of a dance that is meant to mirror the passion of the Christ that she does each day as an act of devotion. And so up until, and depending on geographically where you look, the state varies, up until the mid-1500s, we see dance as a very regular part of religious life and as something that wouldn't have caused medieval Christians to be surprised or alarmed. Now, clearly there's some complications to that, some controversy around that that we'll get into as we go forward. But in general, one scholar said that medieval Christianity is a danced religion, and that's more true than it would seem on the surface from just reading didactic texts or theologians talking about how dance is bad. This does start to change as we move into the early modern period. But especially in England, that's a very gradual change that doesn't really complete until we hit the English Civil Wars.
And I was wondering if I could ask a quick clarifying question. So you mentioned that your research focuses on dance, and I was wondering if you could clarify, does that particularly look at one type of dance? Does it mainly focus on the dance of the laity, or does it focus on all different types of dance?
Right. So my research largely looks at the dance of the laity. That's where the least amount of work has been done. And the main reason for that is that's where we have the fewest sources. When we're talking about dances performed by clerics, we'll often have descriptions in chronicles or descriptions from observers, and that kind of record the steps and the songs that go with that. Another huge area of study, especially from about 1400 onward, is courtly dance, dance performed by noblemen, noble women, in kind of a courtly context. We have dance manuals for that that tell us the steps, that tell us how you would perform those dances. And so there's more work on that as well. For the dance of ordinary men and women in the parish, we have very little left. We don't have any really descriptions of how they danced. We don't have any manuals for how you'd perform their dances. What we have left are these references in parish records and ecclesiastical court records, especially diocesan court records, of dancers who get in trouble, who dance at the wrong time, dance in the wrong place. And then in individual parishes, we have records of payments to dancers or the amount of funds that are raised by dancers. Those don't really give you a clear idea of what type of dance they performed. So to get at that, you then have to dig into sermons that often describe in great detail the dances that the clerics writing the sermons find problematic, which is how we can really get a clear idea as to how ordinary men and women might have been dancing. So the monograph really focuses in on that dance at the parish level performed by ordinary men and women. They're not clerics, they're not nobility, they're just the people of the parish, and this is just a part of the rhythms of their daily life.
Oh, would you be able to share with us an example of a sermon, perhaps, which exemplifies discussions on dance, as you just mentioned? I'm sure that would be quite interesting for our listeners, and selfishly, it sounds very fascinating to me. I'm quite curious to know, what did this dance look like?
Right. So one of the chapters in the book spends quite a bit of time on a specific exemplum, the Tale of the Cursed Dancing Carolers, otherwise known as the Colbeck Dancers. This is a sermon tale that is one of the most popular sermon tales in medieval Europe. It circulates very widely, not just in England, but there are versions in French, there are versions in Swedish, versions in various other Scandinavian languages. It appears in Flemish Crusade texts. It appears in a number of Latin versions. So again, this tale circulates kind of everywhere from the time it starts to originate in the 11th century up until the time of the Reformations. Now, this tale gives us a really good idea of how the carol would have been performed. The carol is a specific form of round dance that's really common in medieval parish settings. And in the tale itself, you have a group of men and women who come to the churchyard on Christmas Eve, and instead of going to Mass, they start to perform this dance, and they're singing loudly. The lyrics are rather rude. They're not really what you should be singing on Christmas Eve while the Mass is going on. And the priest comes out and asks them to stop dancing. They ignore him. They actually get his daughter to join the dance, and we can dig into that a bit more later, but they get his daughter to join the dance, and the priest gets incredibly frustrated. So he prays that God would curse them to dance just like they are for a year without stopping, to teach them about the problems with dancing during church, right? Like, to teach them a lesson about the sacrilege they're committing. And this happens. Now, this is where we get into the description of what the dance actually looked like. The sermon authors note that they continued just as they were, hand in hand, for a year. So right there, we know they're in a circle and their hands are held. They're holding hands while they do this dance. Second, as the dance goes on, the sermon author notes that they sink into the ground from the force of their feet. Now, this gives an idea that carols, when performed by laity, often involved kind of stomping, high knees, a lot of these motions that would help you sink into the ground. And it also references that sometimes they went about jumping after this curse is lifted, and as they did during the dance itself. So there again, we know it's a circular dance, they're stomping, they're sinking into the ground, there's jumping, and so it's quite a vigorous circular dance. Now, again, we don't have any of those descriptions left in the dance manual or something, but from reading the ways in which they're punished and the ways in which this dance is used as punishment, we get a fairly clear idea of what the dance itself would have looked like that we don't really get from other sources.
Oh, thank you for elucidating that. That's really fascinating. And my next question, it's a little bit of a backward step, and you did sort of allude to this earlier in our discussion. And you mentioned earlier that throughout the period that your research is investigating, that attitudes towards dance did change by the latter end of this period. And I wonder if you could say more about that. In what way did attitudes or conceptions or indeed practices of dance change by the end of the period you're investigating?
Certainly. So that's one of the things that I found really interesting in working on this book project, is that when I started the project, I expected to find some stark difference. I expected that we'd see one view in medieval Christianity, and then we'd hit the Reformation, and in England with, you know, the development of Anglicanism, Puritan thought, these various different groups, we would then see a whole different approach to dance. I think most of us are fairly familiar with this idea that the Reformation kind of cracked down and set up these new moral standards that people then had to live by. What I found as I was working on this project is that it's a story of both continuity and of change. The continuity is in the trajectory that these discourses about dance followed and the ways that parish practice then remained very much the same up until the 17th century. So these discussions about dance that start to develop and shift, that shift really starts around Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, as there's this emphasis on reforming the church, on getting rid of quote-unquote pagan practices that may have survived, on making sure that Christians within the church truly behaved as Christians should, that they not only understood their faith, but then lived out their faith. And interestingly, dance is one of the things that comes up frequently in that discussion, because of its role in disrupting worship, in disrupting the space of the churchyard, and disrupting mass. Really, that's the initial concern. We see that thread about dance as problematic and disrupting worship continuing pretty much uninterrupted through the Reformation era discussions of Sabbath and what does it mean to keep the Sabbath and Sabbatarianism. In an English context, this is especially apparent in debates around the Book of Sports, which James I issues in 1618 initially, that says that you can dance on a Sunday afternoon as long as it doesn't interrupt the church service. So these debates about sacrilege, dance, and Sabbath really start with Fourth Lateran and continue in almost the same iteration. They have very similar concerns right up until the 17th century. What does change is the way that gender plays into those discussions. Initially, in these early medieval discussions in the 1200s, they're talking about both men and women dancing and committing sacrilege. It's an equal problem with men and women. Now, at the same time that this discussion is getting going, there's also concern about women and clerical celibacy, and will seeing a woman tempt a priest, will he then break his vows? And so we have a separate discussion going about women and sacrilege. So that commonality of sacrilege helps put dance and women into the same category. And then in the 1400s, we really start to see a concern about sexuality getting layered into this discussion. By the time we hit the 1600s, that concern about dance and sexuality is the overriding concern we hear mentioned in sermons. But it doesn't happen because there's a change in concern. It happens because we see this melding of concern about these various forms of sacrilege, both dancing bodies and female bodies, getting merged into a single concern about dancing women, which is then a concern that is sexualized. So to kind of recap, I know that was a bit long and convoluted there, there is this continuity from the beginning of the period towards the end and the issues associated with dance and then the issues associated with women. What we see changing is that those concerns all overlap and become a single concern that is then about sexualized dancing women. That's really not there in the initial sermons that we start this book with.
That's really interesting. And would you say that's key to the argument of your monograph, looking at sort of the rising intersection between viewing women dancing as something that's sexualized?
That is. The question I kind of started this project with is, why does dance become so problematic? Why is it so prevalent in medieval religion, and then by the time we reach Protestant thought, treated as this incredibly problematic and dangerous thing? And what I argue is that it has to do with the church's attempts to reform, to teach ordinary men and women about sacrilege and how to live out their faith in a proper manner, how to avoid committing sacrilege, how to practice religion in a way that reflects their beliefs. And that discourse has those two strands, that strand about dance that I'm tracing and that strand about women. And clearly there are other things that are involved, but these are the two I follow in this monograph. And has those two separate discourses that both touch on this issue of sacrilege become intertwined and become merged? We see a new discourse emerging out of that, that treats dance as sinful, dance as sexual, and dance as an action that is associated almost exclusively with female bodies. That association changes the status of women within the parish, as well as changes the status of dance itself within Protestant faith.
And do you sense, and you may not be able to answer this question if the sources don't speak to it, but do you sense that dancing was primarily a preoccupation of women, or did men engage in dancing as well in various forms?
Yes, that is one of the most interesting things that came out of comparing these didactic texts, like sermons and conduct manuals, with the records of parish life. So in the didactic texts, women are pretty much always the figures identified with dance and with problematic dancing. When you look at the parish records, men are the main problems, actually, in the parish. We have far more groups of men being brought up and disciplined for dancing on Sundays, dancing during service, getting drunk and dancing, going to villages next door to their own to dance on a Sunday in the hopes that no one would catch them. We actually, from the work I've done, don't have groups of women getting in trouble for dancing. It's pretty much all groups of men, and then occasionally there will be a woman in the group. And oftentimes the sources say the woman was there. They don't specify if she was dancing. So there's this really interesting dichotomy between what's being preached and what's being practiced. And it's fascinating to me to think about the people sitting there and listening to these sermons are probably the women of the parish, while the men of the parish may be out at a dance. But the women are sitting there listening to how women who dance are the tools of the devil, and they're like the devil's cows, the snares of Satan. But they're all listening to the sermon. So it's an interesting bifurcation.
So in that case, when the sermons are being preached, is there a pretty exclusive focus on female dancing? And would you say that the women are even being blamed for any male dancing or any dancing men that is taking place?
Yes. So that's one of the things that this change in understandings of sacrilege and understandings of dance brings about, is a greater blame on women for the sin of men, even if the men are the one kind of initiating these actions. It ultimately, by the time we get to the 1600s, most of these sermons on dance, even if they mention that men are dancing, the blame can eventually be traced back to women, because women have become so rhetorically associated with dance and with sin that if there's an issue that dance is involved in, the clerics kind of find a way to make sure it's clear that it's women's fault, even if the actual practice of the parish doesn't bear that out.
That's really interesting. And I was just wondering, putting you a bit on the spot here, but I was wondering if you had any excerpts that you could share from any sermons that sort of home in on the alleged evil of women dancing.
Right. So, I mean, there's a couple examples that come to mind from the book. One of them, two of the chapters of the book actually look at the dance of Salome, the dancer who's involved in the beheading of John the Baptist in Matthew and Mark's gospel accounts. And I think that gives a really interesting example of how these sermons shift in who's being blamed for sins. So the earliest texts that I look at on Salome, I start actually with looking at the Glossa Ordinaria and some of these scripture commentaries that develop in the 1200s, 1100s. And so in the Glossa Ordinaria, we see a pretty common interpretation from the 8th through 10th centuries presented, which is that Salome is actually an allegory for the true church. The sinners in the narrative are Herod and then Herodias, and Salome is the dancer. She's an allegory for the true church that brings about the death of the law, who's allegorized as John, and the exaltation of Christ, the head of John, who's kind of the culmination of the law. So that's an interpretation that stays pretty confined in clerical texts. But what we do see in sermons are that the blame in that narrative where John the Baptist is beheaded is not really placed on the dancing girl initially. It's placed on Herod, and it's placed on Herod for having this hasty oath, for anger, for adultery. My favorite thing that Herod gets blamed for is having a birthday party. There are a couple of sermons that highlight the fact that only wicked men have birthday parties. And so they mention Herod and Pharaoh as the only two examples of biblical birthday parties. It's a fun aside. But what they highlight in these sermons initially is that Herod is the most responsible for the death of the saint. Now, as we start moving chronologically forward, as we move out of the 1200s and into the 1300s and 1400s, that blame starts to shift, and we start to see Herod still gets quite a bit of blame, but Herodias and Salome, this girl who's dancing in the text, start to be equally blamed for disrespecting God. That's one of the main things they're blamed for, and then for their sexuality, right? For tempting Herod into these oaths and these sins. By the time we move into sermons from the 16th and 17th centuries, Herod is almost blamed not at all, and we have these long rants about women who dance and how they lead to the beheading of godly men in our own time. The sermon authors talk about how Salome is like maids who dance at early modern weddings, who through their dancing and their sexuality, like, bring about the death of godliness in the young men of the village. And so it's this complete flip in who's responsible for the sin in the narrative. From Herod, where the dancing girl's barely mentioned as just kind of a side figure in this narrative of death, to Salome as the real focus of the narrative, and Salome then being read on to the women of the village, the women of the parish, as beheading the godly men of the village. Another example of this is in sermons on a verse in Job that talks about the sons of the wicked dance into hell. And in interpretations of that sermon, oftentimes they'll talk about the sons of the wicked being the ones who are dancing, but then these early modern sermons will spin to talk about the sons of the wicked are dancing because their mothers didn't raise them properly, because their mothers didn't raise them into godliness. Their mothers were out in the streets rather than in the home. And so although the passage from scripture itself talks about young men dancing, the issue, according to these sermon authors' interpretation, is actually their mothers. So again, we're back to the sins of women.
That's really interesting. Thank you. And my next question is a slight shift of gears, I think, moving away from the primary sources that you've been looking at. I was wondering if I could ask you a bit about the secondary scholarship. What have other scholars noted about dance, and how does your research fit into what has already been discovered?
So there's a surprising amount of work that's been done on dance and religion. Particularly recently, we've seen a couple of very good monographs come out looking at this. Older strands of scholarship, such as that by Bachman, who writes a classic text like Dance and the History of the Christian Church, I think is the name. He basically, in talking about medieval religion, notes that they danced. There was a lot of dance happening, points to some of these like communal dance practices, clerical dance practices, and then says, well, when the Reformation starts, those go away and that changes. Barbara Ehrenreich, in her book, Dancing in the Streets, has a very similar take. She kind of, in a survey of communal celebration more generally, notes that in medieval Christianity, Christians danced, and it's these festive things, and then moving forward, that went away, that stopped. We hit the Reformation, and the Protestants crushed it. We also have scholars like Alessandro Arcangeli, who do a lot of work on dance and medieval religion, and many of his works have looked at the ways in which all these didactic texts present dance as problematic. He's done a lot of work on dance and sermons and these kind of stories about horrific things that happen to dancers, this negative clerical approach that we often see has kind of the other stereotype of dance in the medieval church. Along with this, more recent works by Catherine Dickison and Laura Helston have looked at medieval dance as a form of doing theology. And both of their works have started with the patristic authors like Augustine and Chrysostom and traced out kind of reception into the medieval church And then, especially in a continental context, this dance performed by clerics, dance is a form of holiness, dance is a form of penance. One thing that I think is interesting is that a lot of these works look at medieval Europe broadly, and in doing so, they'll often draw their examples from continental Europe, from France, from Italy, from these regions that actually have far more positive traditions towards dance than medieval England. A lot of these clerical dances we don't actually see happening as much in medieval England, which is an interesting distinction. Another thing that I think is important to note that this book does a little bit differently is it really centers gender in its analysis. I'm very much engaging with religion of ordinary men and women and the ways that's presented in sermons as opposed to in theological treatises or these more formal ecclesiastical texts. But along with that, in centering ordinary men and women, I'm also really centering gender and how gender plays into this discussion. Because I think when we think about dance, we have to remember that it's a practice that's very embodied. It's performed by human bodies that are very clearly then forced into kind of understandings of what it means to perform gender as well as to perform dance. Hopefully that kind of gave an overview of what's going on there right now.
I really like the last line that you just said, looking at sort of the differences between performing gender and performing dance. And for my next question, I was wondering if I could ask a bit more about other denominations. I mean, I know that you're looking at Anglicans for your research, but I was wondering if you could speak at all about how dance was practiced or how it was conceptualized in other denominations at this time.
Right. So starting with kind of medieval parishes, medieval English parishes had far less clerical dance that I found than some of their continental counterparts. But we have a very rich record of dance among laity in these parishes, which I think maybe changes how we think about what the practice of dance in medieval English parishes looked like. It was far less a practice by elites and far more a practice by the ordinary people, which I think is distinctive from what it looks like in France in particular. Moving into kind of the Anglican church, we see that continue. We see initially very few of these Anglican clerics engaging in some of these dance practices, which, to be clear, do disappear throughout Europe in general in the Reformations, even in areas that remain Catholic. In an attempt to kind of counter these Protestant criticisms, often clerical dance itself also disappears. But in the Anglican church in particular, it remains very much the domain of laity up until it's kind of formally forbidden and removed from church practice. I do think the fact that dance in England is so much associated in religious contexts with laity rather than clerics means that once we start to see dance being transitioned out of a part of regular life, that discourse is more gendered than in other contexts. It's far easier to criticize the women of the parish and thus to kind of move dance out using that than it is in a different context to criticize like clerical practice. I also think that that more negative discourse and that gendered discourse very much continues within Anglican circles for a surprisingly long time. Some of our listeners might be familiar with Stuart Headlam, who's this kind of eccentric 19th century Anglican priest. And one of the things he's accused of amidst a long list of things that get him in trouble with kind of the Anglican clergy of the time is that he's a fan of balletology, so idolatry of the ballet. He actually seeks to reach and bring ballet dancers into the church and argues that ballet dance is a form of worship. It's a form of mirroring beauty. It's a form of kind of using the body to praise and exalt God. And that does not go over well in a 19th century context. All his critics are talking about the dangers of ballet dancers and the tights they're wearing and the ways in which they lead to the downfall of the young men of the society. These discourses that are really familiar sounding, and if you go back and look at 15th and 16th century sources, they take root in Anglican practice, and they're not really questioned. They're assumed to be, this is what it means to practice the faith. So we also see that playing out kind of within the British Empire. As we see missionaries going out, one of the things they'll identify as a mark of sacrilegious practice, and then has a mark of an effeminate society is celebratory dance. So these medieval and then Anglican perspectives about dance as sacrilegious and as a woman's pastime really carry on for a very long time within the Anglican tradition, somewhat unnoticed because they develop so slowly. It's hard to notice that that is a specific discourse that's unique to your community or more unique to your community when it's developed over several hundred years through these various iterations.
Interesting. And you spoke about how views towards dance in continental Europe weren't viewed with the same negative conception as they were in England. And I was wondering if you sense that Catholic conceptions of dance or interpretations of dance, whether they were a bit more open to it or more tolerant.
So in continental settings, yes. And this is, again, not exactly within the scope of the book, but in kind of reading and researching about various medieval and early modern approaches to dance, there are far more positive uses of dance within the church going on longer within these French and Italian contexts in particular. Within England, once we hit the 16th century, there's actually not a strong difference along Catholic and Protestant lines and approaches to dance. And that's one of the things that I found very interesting. I read through somewhere around 300 different early modern sermons from between about 1480 up until 1640 was my cutoff, that referenced dance. And whether the authors are Anglican, Puritan, Catholic, didn't really seem to matter in how they talked about dance. Within England, because of that gendered aspect, there's this broad consensus that transcends denominational lines. And I can't say for sure if that's true or not true on the continent. I haven't done as much reading in those sermon sources. But especially in the medieval sources, there's far more positive ground given for dance in French and Italian contexts and some of the sermons that come out of that than there is in England and in the vernacular sermons there.
And speaking of sources, I wonder if I can ask you a question about your sources. Can you say a bit more about what sources you used for this research? I know that you've mentioned sermons. Did you use anything else? And indeed, what was your process? How did you go about finding these sources to use for your research?
Wonderful. So I did start primarily with using sermons. I used the Repertorium of Middle English Prose Sermons as a good starting point and looked up kind of every scriptural reference that talked about dance, every figure in scripture who had dance as a part of their narrative. And then I honestly read a lot of different medieval sermon cycles looking for dance and where it appeared in there. I looked at the Index Exemplorum, which is a collection of sermon tales and kind of categorizes where you see dance appearing in sermon tales, and used that to then track down a number of medieval sermons as well. And then for my early modern sermons, I spent a lot of time searching through early English books online, various ways to spell dance, these different references for dance forms that got pulled up there. From that basis of looking at sermons, I then also did layer on other didactic texts. I looked at scripture translations, I looked at glosses, I looked at scripture commentaries. Some conduct manuals has appropriate when they pulled things from religious sources into these conduct manuals. And that gave me a pretty broad base in these didactic texts that are meant to be teaching tools. They're, for my book, I limited myself primarily exclusively to sources in the vernacular that would have been aimed at a primarily lay audience. Formal theological treatises, Latin texts, those really fell with the outside of the purview of what I was hoping to look at. Because what I sought to understand was, what would your ordinary member of the church have heard, have known, and have been taught about dance? One thing that I want to note before I move on to talk about my second major body of sources is how difficult it was in some ways to run down dance across all of those threads, because very few sermon authors sat down and went, we're going to write a sermon that is just about dance. No one thought it was important enough to justify its own sermon topic. And I think that's one reason scholarship has not looked at it as thoroughly. You know, you'll have whole sermons on various issues, but dance is not one of those that makes that cut as, you know, an issue of great importance. However, once you start looking for it in these sermons, it's everywhere. I know I mentioned somewhere around 300 early modern sermons that talk about it. We've probably got 40 to 50 medieval sermons that talk about it in some form. That's a significant number of mentions of something, but it's always done in an aside or has an illustration of a larger point, which means I think a lot of the rhetoric and theology that's built up around dance is done almost inadvertently. It's done in talking about these issues that are important for applying the fundamentals of the faith, but not necessarily done in a way that's a careful, measured theological way of thinking, which I think is part of why we see these slow changes over time. Every time dance is talked about, it's tweaked a little or a little bit is added on, but there's not one discourse about dance that authors are going back to and kind of revisiting. So pivoting from there to the other body of sources, how did this rhetoric actually then play out? For tracking down dance in those sources, I relied fairly heavily on the records of early English drama. It's a project that goes through the earliest records of performance in England in all of these various counties and parishes, starting in the 1300s and again running up until the English Civil War, when we see a lot of that festive culture being shut down. This was a huge advantage for a project like mine. One of the things I valued in setting up the project was this chronological breadth to get an idea of what's happening as far as change or continuity over time, but also breadth across multiple parishes to get in a sense of the broader culture around dance rather than a localized culture. So in going through the records of early English drama findings, they've pulled up things from parish records, from individual church wardens' accounts, as well as from diocesan court cases, from visitation records. It's a whole array of various sources that talk about what's actually happening in the parish and what's going on the ground. And so pulling together those two bodies of records allowed me to look at both what's taught and then what's practiced when it comes to dance in the English parish in this period.
And thinking a little bit more about this, did you find anything that surprised you in the course of your research?
Yes. So I think the first surprise in working through this was how little things changed for ordinary men and women despite the English Reformations. In a lot of ways, I think our narrative of the English Reformations is that, you know, there's all these theological changes, there's this political back and forth as to the religion of the community, and that does have an effect eventually. But for those living through the 1500s, the 1600s, their practice of parish festivity, of dance, of these kind of ways of living in the parish changed far less than I expected. I think a second surprise was how little discourses around dance changed in individual texts and how the changes in the way that the church taught and thought about dance were very, very slow and took place over hundreds of years. And yet the endpoint was so different. There was never a point in my research at which it's like, aha, that's the moment that everything changed, or that's the thing that made dance problematic as opposed to a good thing. It was this very nuanced and very subtle shift. And the way that gender played into that meant there was this nuanced and subtle shift in the way that women were talked about and then were treated in the parish as well, that I think looking at just 50 years or 100 years, I would have missed. It's not something where there's a clear shift until you look very broadly. I think we mentioned this earlier, but the number of men who get in trouble for dancing, whereas in the sermons, if you just read the sermons, you would think it's all women dancing. If you just look at the parish records, you think really it's the men who are the problem. That was the first time I realized that, a huge surprise. I think those are kind of the biggest three surprises. There were a couple of stories that really struck me. A couple of these things that in looking through parish records, a couple of accounts that I found really striking that I talk about in my conclusion. But those were kind of illustrative of some of these larger points.
Brilliant. Thank you. And perhaps we can leave more details about the stories to our listeners to discover for themselves when your monograph comes out in November. And so my final question for you that focuses quite explicitly on the academic side of this research, I suppose, is to ask you the so what question, I guess. Why would you say this particular avenue of research is quite valuable?
So I think one of the things that's really valuable about this project is the insight it gives into the lived experience of faith for ordinary men and women on a parish level. I think especially in this period of transition from medieval Christianity into early modern Christianity, this project gives a pretty unique glimpse into some of the rhythms of daily life that we don't often think about, right? This rhythm of festive culture, of celebration, of various forms of worship that happen outside of the space of the church itself. We get a much clearer glimpse at what that looks like from this project. I think a second valuable contribution from this is looking at the ways in which we see clerical discourse subtly shifting to become more misogynistic and more rigid in its approach to gender across this time period. One of the things I find really interesting and important about this work is that in discussing dance and kind of dealing with this adiaphora, this issue that doesn't have a clear answer in scripture as to how it should be approached in a communal church context, but that you have to grapple with if you're trying to teach and kind of guide the people of your parish, we see the discussion becoming increasingly negative towards women, towards women's bodies, and towards women's ability to live holy lives. And I think in a lot of ways, that is not necessarily something that was initially intended. I think these clerics in discussing this and trying to get from an idea of we should protect the church to what does that look like, we see the emphasis of the misogyny in some of these other texts and some of their cultural contexts really seeping in ways that then you wouldn't recognize initially, but by the end of this time period, have very real ramifications for women. It's the ways in which discourse kind of shapeshifts to perpetuate misogyny and to perpetuate these structures of power that we miss if we're only looking at big shifts or at big theological ideas. It's in these kind of daily actions and these daily frameworks for how do you live a holy life that we really see the increase in limitations on women and what they're allowed to do and how they're thought about and treated in this period. And interestingly, along with that, this has some pretty intense ramifications for men as well. As the sixth chapter of my book talks about, when you start to treat an act as something that only women do and that is sinful, if you're a man who dances, all of a sudden you are also maybe effeminate, maybe you're not a real man, right? And I think kind of the third big contribution of this project is in showing how we see these broad ideas taking place, not just at parish levels, but within like a broad cultural context. I think kind of the third big contribution of this project is in showing when we trace issues like dance across broad chronological scopes, across broad geographic scopes in an English context, we see these really big changes that otherwise we would miss. Previous studies of dance in the English parish often, and really there haven't been that many, but they've often looked at one parish or the practice of dance in one area. And when you start to look more broadly, you see that there are these big changes and big trends taking place that then have particular local impacts, but that otherwise you would have missed. So I think just in kind of modeling a methodology for understanding some of these lay experiences, I think we have to look broader than we are inclined to see some of these changes and to really understand kind of the rhetoric within which laity are living their lives.
Thank you. And my final two questions for you in this podcast interview are a shift towards the personal, I suppose, if I may. My first one is about inspiration. What inspired you to investigate this avenue of research?
So it's perhaps not surprising that the initial interest in dance as a topic came out of a background as a dancer. I did dance from the age of 3 up until 18 when a knee injury caused me to kind of shift focus from a dance career towards a career in history. But as far as this specific project, I actually stumbled into it a bit by mistake from doing some work on the development of dance halls in the 1920s. and looking at these kind of modern iterations of dance culture and dance halls, I kept running into this religious rhetoric against dance. And I started tracing that backwards, which is clearly a dangerous thing to do, as it led to me to shift from being a modernist to primarily a medievalist. I ended up going from 1920 back to 1220 and then kind of digging in and staying there. So it was this consistent rhetoric from within Protestant circles against dance, juxtaposed with my own background as a dancer, that had me really interested in where did this come from? What led to this? And once I started digging into kind of these shifts when dance went from being a positive part of church life to something that the church largely discussed in Protestant circles with condemnation until fairly recently, that's when I realized how much gender had to do with the story. And that's really what kind of led to the development of this book.
Thank you. That was very interesting. And so my final question before I let you go, my final personal question, so to speak, is really the what's next question. And so this monograph is finished, coming out in November for all of our listeners and myself to read. And I was wondering, do you have any other projects going on at the moment, or indeed what's next for you?
Right. So there are a couple of articles that are in the works that are kind of tangents that didn't really fit within the broader book. One of these is an article looking at dancing mania, gender, and heresy in the Middle Ages. I have an article coming out sometime in the next year about parish preaching and parish dance in not only England, but also in Western Scandinavia, looking primarily at Norway and Iceland and doing some comparative work there. As I move away from this project and kind of associated articles towards the next project, I'm starting to look at the ways in which lay devotion and the teaching of laity within religious contexts helps form gendered ideas of emotion. And that's particularly in York that I'm looking at. This is something else that I kind of ran across in working on this book that didn't make it into the book but sparked this train of interest. A lot of the psalters and various psalm interpretations talk about dance and joy. And I noticed that a lot of the discussion of joy and how it should be experienced and felt by Christians was split along these very gendered lines. Men were told to practice joy in one way, and women were told to practice joy in another. And so the next project is kind of a history of religion, lay piety, and emotion, looking at the ways in which religious texts teach men and women through their religious practice to feel emotion, and then how gender plays a role in that story as well.
Well, we look forward to hearing about the fruition of that research as well in due course. And Lyneth, I was wondering if, before I let you go, if you wouldn't mind reminding our listeners of the title of your monograph and where they might procure a copy for themselves when it comes out in November.
Of course. So the book is Women, Dance, and Parish Religion in England, 1300 to 1640, and it's coming out with Boydell. I believe pre-orders open up in late August, and the book itself should be out sometime in late November. It's a part of their Gender in the Middle Ages series.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. Stay tuned for our next podcast episode, which will be advertised on our social media pages. If you're not currently a member of EHS, we highly recommend you consider doing so. It's a great opportunity to network with other like-minded historians and keep abreast of latest research in the field. More information is on our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com.